This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Du, wie wär's mit einem Skitrip zum Winterstart? Da gibt's doch coole Events.
Ich bin schon so lange nicht mehr auf Skiern gestanden und weiß nicht, was lässig ist. Was pfeifen Sie da überhaupt?
Na, den Home of Lessig Song.
Nicht lang überlegen. Den lässigsten Start in den Winter gibt's mit dem Bergfestival und Rave on Snow im Skizirkus Saalbach hinter Glemm-Leogang Fieberbrunn. Willkommen im Home of Lessig. Info und Buchung unter saalbach.com.
Hello, I'm Blessing Adiroba, bringing you Focus on Africa from Lagos, Nigeria. Like Charles Gitonga in Nairobi, I'll be stepping in from time to time for our main presenter, Audrey Brown. Now, let me tell you what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. We'll be discussing the new passport being introduced by Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, the states that left the West African Union, ECOWAS, to form an alliance of their own. How will it affect the movement of people across the region?
So the real impact for tourism or for trade is really going to happen when AES citizens need to get their passports renewed. Because when they get them renewed, they will only get the AES passport. They won't get the ECOWAS passport. And the question then is whether ECOWAS will respect that. And you would assume they wouldn't, because otherwise, what are the benefits of being within ECOWAS?
And why is Sierra Leone's president being linked to one of Europe's most wanted criminals? It's Monday, the 3rd of February. First, we go to Gabon. The military government recently announced that the presidential elections will be held on the 12th of April. It's a key step to re-establish civilian rule following a coup in August 2023. Here's my colleague Yvette Twagira-Maria with some information about Gabon and how it got here.
Gabon is located in Central Africa and has significant amount of natural resources. Its border countries are Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, and the Republic of Congo. Despite its vast area, Gabon has just over 2.3 million inhabitants. Half of Gabon's population is under 20. Despite its economic potential, the country struggles to translate its resource wealth into sustainable and inclusive growth. The country became a single-party state, dominated by the Gabonese Democratic Party in 1967, when Omar Bongo Ondimba came to power. The then president's son, Ali Bongo Ondimba, succeeded him in 2009 and was re-elected in August 2016 in a highly controversial election marked by a relatively low voter turnout. He, however, was deposed on August 30, 2023, following a military intervention which was orchestrated by the Committee for the Transition and Restoration of Institutions. Brigadier General Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema was appointed president of the Gabonese transition. In November last year, military authorities said an overwhelming majority of Gabonese people voted for a new constitution. The proposed new constitution introduced two-term limits on the presidency. General Nguema said the vote reflected the government's commitment towards the transition. Gabon's Council of Ministers recently announced that the presidential elections will be held on the 12th of April, marking an end to the military rule that began with a coup on August 30th, 2023.
And that's Yvette Twagira-Maria. Transitional President General Brice Oligui Nguema, who took over, made no secret of his ambitions to remain in power. So, how significant are these scheduled presidential elections? I've been speaking to Professor Joseph Sigal, who is the Director of Research at the African Center for Strategic Studies.
Well, it's significant for several reasons. First, the original date was that the elections would be in August, so 2 years after the coup. And so the fact that they're now moving it to April means they're trying to speed up the process. The expectation is that they're trying to quickly finalize the consolidation of power of General Oligui, that he's a junta leader and self-declared transition president. And so they want to continue to move the process very quickly to formalize his authority as president before there can be a real transparent process and dialogue on what a genuinely competitive process would look like.
So are we saying that the April 12th election is not going to transition us to proper democracy?
Yeah, I think that is the fundamental question. What do we want to call this event? You know, the process since the coup has been heavily stage managed. The junta leader and the military have really controlled every step of the process. They've appointed 2/3 of the members of the Senate National Assembly. They've named all 9 members of the Constitutional Court. They've replaced the authority of the National Election Commission, so that's run by the government. They held a national dialogue in which 200 opposition parties were omitted from participating. And they then authorized leaders of the military to run for political office. And there's just a fundamental question about under what authority are they making these changes, since they are the ones who seized power. So it's been very controlled, and it isn't clear that the opposition is going to have very much space to compete on a level playing field.
Give us a picture of what this transition would be like. Would there be other political parties involved? And would people, you know, have the opportunity to vote who they want? And would you say this is a transition to democracy?
I do not see it as a transition to democracy by any means. This is a effort to give the appearance of an election. And so there will be voting. There will be some opposition party members who will likely be allowed to run. But, you know, what we have seen in the referendum that was held last year to ratify the process is that the media landscape will be heavily controlled in favor of what the junta is preferring. Opposition members will be harassed and will have a harder time to campaign. And because the electoral management body is going to be controlled by the government, it isn't clear that the counting will be fair. I think that is the real question here, is what are we going to call an election when there's such heavy-handed management of it?
I want us to compare these to other African countries currently under military rule. In terms of the military government commitment to ensuring there's an election in keeping its promise. Now, Gabon, when it came into power in August 2023, you know, promised an election. In terms of comparison, how would you rate its commitment in ensuring this promise comparing to other countries?
Certainly, there is a fulfillment of the effort to move forward with an election. But again, we have to think about what that election entails. What do we really define as election if the outcome is already known? And so what appears to be happening in Gabon is a replication of the transition playbook we saw from General Mohamed Deby in Chad, who also seized power unconstitutionally following the death of his father in April 2021, and then declared himself the head of the transition, you know, managed a constitutional referendum, and then held a so-called election in May of 2024, which, of course, he won. And despite massive protest and, you know, the killing of opposition members and that sort of thing. And so I think that's the template that we're seeing in Gabon. And so I think for journalists and analysts and observers, the question is, do we count this as an election or not? Now, there are other juntas who you're referring to in the Sahel who have seized power, and they're not holding elections despite having promised to do so. But I think, you know, the point here is that when the promise is made of election, the idea is that it's a return to civilian rule, that if there's a return to democratic competition, freedom of expression, assembly, ability to organize, people to get out different visions of what they want for their country. You know, that's the real essence of an election. And that's what's lacking here in Gabon.
So now with the new electoral law, which allows the military personnel to participate in the election, and this came after the announcement of the election, can this law be revoked?
It's hard to see how it can be revoked under the current system, because the system is being controlled by the military, including the Constitutional Court. where the members have been summarily replaced. So this is a question of legality and challenging the authority of the junta to set the rules is the fundamental issue here about how we're looking at this.
So what do you think about the referendum that happened in November last year about the presidential term?
So as part of the process of consolidating power, what we saw is that the presidential term was going to be extended from 5 years to 7 years. The position of the prime minister would be eliminated and the other institutions of shared power would be diminished. And so the overall thrust of this is to create an increasingly centralized hold on power in the hands of the president.
Tell us a little bit about General Brice and how he has ruled so far. How would this impact Gabon's future?
It's interesting because General Brice has presented himself as a reformer, having ended 56-year dynasty of the Bongos. The Bongo dynasty was very unpopular and was seen as having itself run fraudulent elections and amassed huge amounts of wealth for itself at the expense of the population. But what is overlooked is that General Brice was very close to the Bongo family. He was the aide-de-camp of Omar Bongo, who had ruled the country until 2009 in his death. And then he was the head of the presidential guard of Ali Bongo, the son, up until the time that he mounted the coup. It's also notable that General Brice is a cousin of Ali Bongo. So he was very close to the Bongo family, and the reports are that he too gained a lot of wealth under that regime. And so the expectation is that we're seeing more of a continuation of the Bongo dynasty, but under the military now, rather than under the Bongo family. I think under the current trajectory, we can't expect to see much change. Gabon will continue to be a wealthy country. It has one of the highest per capita incomes in Africa, $9,000 per capita income per year, a lot of natural resource wealth, small population, but high levels of inequity, 40% unemployment in the country.
Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the African Center for Strategic Studies. Countries along the coast of West Africa have long been classified as transit stations for drug trafficking from South America to Europe and America. And it seems that the problem is getting worse. In Guinea, officials seized a vehicle linked to Sierra Leone's embassy in Conakry. The Guineans say it was stuffed full of cocaine and cash. Then, just weeks later, a fugitive convicted Dutch cocaine trafficker was said to have been spotted in the country attending a church service in the president's hometown. So, I was intrigued as to how President Julius Maada Bio might know Jos Lydekkers, Europe's most wanted criminal. I got to Maru Fofana, who is in Freetown, to tell me more.
Well, the man is Jos Lydekkers, who is a convicted cocaine trafficker in the Netherlands and is on Europe's most wanted list for his alleged role of trafficking drugs across Europe. And he is said to be the most wanted man, in fact, in the Netherlands. There's a 200,000 euro bounty on his head in his own country. Now, the Dutch Public Prosecution Service says that investigations show that he attended the New Year's Day service in Sierra Leone at the St. Joseph's Church, as did the president of Sierra Leone and his family in a small southern presidential hometown of Tion, just a couple of pews he was alleged to be sitting from the president's Julius Maada Bio inside the church. And a spokesman for the Dutch Prosecution Service says that they will do all they can to get Just back to serve his 24-year jail term in the Netherlands. The Dutch government says that the man apparently spotted in official State House pictures of the church service, whom they say is Just, has been living in Sierra Leone for at least 6 months. Now, the Sierra Leone government says they are investigating the allegations, but they have neither denied nor confirmed that the man in the pictures is in fact Jos Lydicus. But they stress that there has been no official request made to the government of Sierra Leone by the Dutch authorities for either his extradition or for anything else. So far, that's what we have.
Okay, do we know the relationship between this man, Jos, and the first family? How did he find himself, you know, in the church service with the president in his hometown? I know church service is an open event, but tell us a bit more about the relationship.
Well, the allegations in the Dutch media include that Jos has a relationship with the daughter, one of the daughters of President Julius Malabio, and that he was in that church at the behest of that daughter. The information minister, Chernobyl, says that he does not wish to comment on individual people's private life, and he considers whatever relationship there may or may not be between the president's daughter and Jos to be a private affair. So at a press conference, he would not comment on whether or not president's daughter and Jos were either married or whether they have any personal relationship whatsoever. In terms of why he found himself in the church service as the president, this is what Chernobyl had to say.
We, the Sierra Leonean government, have not received any formal correspondence and had no reason to review at any point that if the individual of this sort was in our territorial region. And because of that, obviously we were not looking for a particular individual that has been reported or the issues that have been reported in the media. So this individual, I wouldn't say, was in the entourage of His Excellency. However, I would agree that there was an individual that is now the subject of speculation who was at the church service of His Excellency.
That is Chernobyl, Sierra Leone's Minister of Information.
So all this comes just weeks after the seizure of, in Guinea, of a vehicle belonging to the Sierra Leone embassy there. How much do you know about that?
Apparently on New Year's Eve, on the 31st of December, an official Sierra Leone embassy vehicle was on its way to the capital of Guinea from Sierra Leone, but the driver was stopped by some members of the Guinean security forces, and they searched the vehicle, even though it had a Sierra Leone diplomatic registration number, which one would assume means that it cannot be subject to any search. But then it was searched, and they discovered packs of cocaine said to be anywhere around 285 kilograms inside the vehicle. So the vehicle was impounded. The driver was arrested, as was a passenger, somebody else who was inside the vehicle. And it was alleged that the ambassador in Guinea had something to do with it. So the Guinean authorities made a formal request to the government of Sierra Leone for the ambassador to have his immunity lifted so they would try him in Guinea-Conakry on drugs-related charges. But the government of Sierra Leone has up to this time not lifted his immunity. They've recalled him. But my information is that he cannot come because the Guinean authorities will not let him leave the country. The ambassador has not been arrested, apparently because of his diplomatic status, but then his recall has not happened because the Guinean authorities will not release him to come.
Okay, so how widespread is the issue of drugs in Sierra Leone? West Africa has been known to be a major transit point for the trafficking of cocaine from Latin America.
The indications are that, drug trafficking is very widespread in Sierra Leone. And in fact, last year, President Julius Malabio declared drug substance abuse in Sierra Leone as a public health emergency. He apparently had in mind the synthetic drug here known as Kush, which has been wreaking havoc on young people, but it was widely opened to include all drugs. And then before that happened, it's safe to say that some 12 or so years ago, a plane load of cocaine landed at the country's international airport in pitch darkness at the time. There were parking vehicles waiting for the passengers on board this aircraft who were whisked away by these waiting vehicles. They rammed into the perimeter fence and found their way in a typical Hollywood movie script kind of way. They rammed into the perimeter fence of the airport and escaped from the airport. Eventually, there was a manhunt and they were arrested. They were tried. Among them, five or six South Americans And eventually those South Americans were taken by the United States government to the United States to serve their jail term and probably be subjected to further investigations and trials. So it's not new, but the indications had been that it had sort of like, you know, reduced. But then recent happenings will suggest that it is still widespread in Sierra Leone. On the side of the local synthetic drug known as Kush, the government seems to have set up some structures in terms of dealing with those who abuse substance relating to Kush. In terms of cocaine, the assumption is that it is not really consumed in Sierra Leone. It's a transit point where it is brought into from South America and then shipped across the borders to either Guinea or Liberia and then taken to Europe or to the Americas.
I'm just wondering, you know, when this post came online, what were people saying? What were people of Sierra Leone saying? What was the conversation online?
Conversation has been very heated. People have given the authorities a serious flak here. I mean, the fact that an embassy vehicle was, involved in it in Guinea, as was confirmed by both the government of Sierra Leone and the government of Guinea, people have been really pouring out outrage, condemnation, and urging the authorities to act. You know, so the government has got a lot of PR to do. The fact that the allegations are that Joss has some ties to the First Family will be something which has to be deeply investigated. And if any truth found in that, then actions taken. But there has been real anger and indignation as expressed on social media over these recent happenings.
Umaru Fofana, a journalist in Freetown. This is Focus in Africa from the BBC World Service. Now we go to Mali, Niger and Burkina Faso. The three Sahel countries, now under military rule, they have officially left the economic community of West African states. Their departure means ECOWAS is losing three of its founding members. They are now calling themselves the Alliance of Sahel States. ECOWAS originally comprised 15 countries, and it was set up to unify the region politically, socially, and economically. Nearly 425 million people would be able to move and trade freely, a formidable force. That was the dream. Now, three French-speaking countries under military rule have introduced a new passport, discarding the ECOWAS document. This move, which comes alongside their withdrawal from ECOWAS, is part of a push to strengthen ties within the Alliance of Sahel States. ECOWAS is hoping that they would reconsider. So it has granted these countries a six-month grace period until July to rejoin the organization. I've been speaking to Dr. Danielle Resnick, Senior Research Fellow in the Markets, Trade and Institutions Unit at the International Food Policy Research Institute, to find out how the new passport will work and how this move might impact the relationship between the new alliance and the rest of ECOWAS.
So, I mean, there's two potential impacts it could have on, you think about trade and tourism, for instance. But I don't think it's actually going to have anything significant in terms of impact in those two domains, because the three AES countries already have a high level of population movement among them. They were citizens of the three countries were already previously able to move across borders very easily under the ECOWAS passport. So the AES passport doesn't really add anything additional for citizens of those three countries that they didn't already have. Now, in terms of trade, because there's very similar agroecologies in the Sahel, they also have very similar production profiles. So there's not a clear differentiation in the types of products, economic products, that they can offer each other. In fact, much of their trade is much higher externally and with their coastal ECOWAS country partners than with each other. So when you think about it, there need to be kind of, you know, real economic opportunities to also incentivize population movements. And that's why up until now, most migration in the region has occurred predominantly from the poor Sahel, the AES countries, to the relatively richer coastal ECOWAS countries like Ghana, Nigeria, Senegal, and Cote d'Ivoire. The bigger impact, I think, could, you know, potentially down the line be on trade, but I think that would come more from a change in tariff rates between the ECOWAS and AES countries rather than the passport per se.
Okay, so from what I'm getting here, it seems like an isolation, and I think it would impact them a bit more. I feel they get to stand to benefit more in terms of trade relations. Would this mean that they would get to trade more with non-ECOWAS states, or would they want to further the relationship with ECOWAS states?
Well, I don't think, you know, in terms of both the passport or the potential tariff change in tariff rates, which has not been announced yet by ECOWAS, I don't expect a massive shift in the trade profiles of the AES countries for a few reasons. First, the passport, for instance, is really, as I said earlier, you know, more symbolic. But historically, the ECOWAS passport was a manifestation of a reality in the region, which is the high degree of cross-border movement among nationals in the region due to, you know, very common linguistic, culture, and historic linkages. And those linkages are not going to change because of a passport. And those Sahel countries and nationals who are trading, cross-border trading, don't have the same types of relationships with, for instance, North African countries neighboring them, but who are outside of ECOWAS. Secondly, these three countries actually already have pretty significant trade with countries outside of ECOWAS. Mali, its major export is gold. It's 70% of its export earnings are from gold. They're not trading that to other ECOWAS countries. They're trading with the United Arab Emirates, with Switzerland, with South Africa. Similarly, you know, Burkina has a lot of gold, Niger, a lot of uranium, and they're major cotton exporters as well. And they're already exporting quite a bit outside of ECOWAS. Third, I don't think there'll be too much of a profile change in their trade, because for agricultural products like tomatoes and onions that are in high demand already in ECOWAS countries, these are very perishable, and without good cold storage, they really need to be traded over short distances, and they're also quite low value. And so there's not going to be much demand for those from countries outside of ECOWAS. So for the short term, I don't think that we're going to see, you know, the ability of this change in the passport, for instance, to really affect their ability to, you know, really significantly shift their trade profile.
In terms of tourism, how would this impact the region, the Sahel states?
In terms of tourism, I mean, the main issue is to think forward in terms of whether this is going to have a big impact and whether the AES is going to respect the ECOWAS passports and vice versa. So I think we won't see the impact on either tourism or trade for quite a while, because right now the AES countries have said that their current citizens can take up the new passport when their current ECOWAS passport expires. And they have said in the meantime, they will not impose any visas on ECOWAS citizens, even though they reserve the right to refuse entry to what they call inadmissible immigrants. So they haven't really defined what that means. But currently for the AES states, no real change in terms of restricting ECOWAS citizens to come into their three countries. And at the same time, ECOWAS has said it's going to continue to respect ECOWAS passports from nationals of the AES countries. So the real impact for tourism or for trade, as we've already discussed, is really going to happen when AES citizens need to get their passports renewed. Because when they get them renewed, they will only get the AES passport. They won't get the ECOWAS passport. And the question then is whether ECOWAS country will respect that. And you would assume they wouldn't, because otherwise, what are the benefits of being within ECOWAS? There aren't, you know, clear distinctions about the benefits you get and you don't get by being part of this economic community.
Can you remind us what the benefits of being within the ECOWAS states?
Well, there's many benefits in terms of regional cooperation. The organization has a number of different agencies. For instance, they have the West African Health Organization that has up until now been based in Burkina Faso. And this really helps coordinate health responses. If you think back to the Ebola crisis, was a very key actor there. Lots of coordination on animal and food safety, because you do have a lot of trade and agricultural produce coming across the borders. You need to have checks in terms of ensuring that you're not importing foot and mouth disease, for instance, from livestock coming down from the Sahel. And a lot of other efforts that they were in the midst of pursuing. In addition to the ECOWAS passport, there had also been efforts to create an ECOWAS national biometric identity card for those who do not have passports. And that's really key for really, you know, quite poor informal traders in region who might go every day back and forth to trade their goods, but who didn't actually have a passport. And that was something that the World Bank was financing. And several of the now AES countries were in the midst of finalizing that and now will be part of that effort. So there's quite a few benefits that they certainly can be losing out from now that they've exited from ECOWAS.
So what should we expect in terms of the future of the AES? And do you see this move as something that would trigger other countries to want to leave ECOWAS?
Well, I think we've already seen an indication by Togo. Its foreign minister raised alarms by saying that they may also consider joining the AES. There's potential speculation, would Guinea also leave? It was also under the control of a military junta, so it could potentially also be a member. But several countries, Senegal, Ghana, they've been quite vocal about not trying to alienate the AES country leaders, the military leaders there, and really recognize, particularly as we're seeing security threats, military threats come into some of the coastal West African countries like Ghana, like Benin. You know, the whole region needs to continue to work together. And it's not in really anyone's interest to stop communication and to stop kind of diplomatic relations between the ECOWAS and AES countries.
Dr. Daniel Resnick, Senior Research Fellow in the Markets, Trade and Institution Unit at the International Food Policy Research Institute. Focus on Africa was put together by Bella Hassan and Yvette Twagira Maria in London. Jonathan Greer was our technical producer and Carney Sharp was the senior producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are editors. I'm Blessing Adirogba and I'll see you tomorrow.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.